Okay, we're fine. Today's date is May 5th, 1983. My name is Chris Bell. I'm speaking today with Brigadier General John Adam at his home out in Oak Bay. And last day, which was many days ago, we got up to the point where Brigadier Adam had gone to England as the advanced party of the 6th Brigade, and you would you're stationed just outside of Aldershot. And your duties were to prepare the camp for the troops and to scout around the local area. And I think you had been assigned to an anti-tank company within the brigade, which had died on your trip over. And that is where we got to last time, so perhaps you could pick up the story from there.
Right. This was in... We were in a barracks called Guillemont Barracks, mm-hmm. just outside of Aldershot, in a little village called Cove. And we arrived there in September, and expecting the brigade, the 6th Brigade, to come over any time. And actually, it didn't arrive. The whole brigade didn't arrive until December 1940.
What held them up?
Well, I suppose it was just making arrangements to get the whole division, 2nd Division, together. And it was probably just sea transport that probably held up the...
Now, if you'd think in late 1940, everything would be confused in Canada.
It was pretty well.
Yeah.
And... So the brigade arrived in December and moved into, we had with us at that time, there were the South Saskatchewan Regiment mm-hmm. and the Camerons of Winnipeg and the Calgary Highlanders. And in the meantime, the Fusiliers de Montréal, had been stationed in Iceland, and they came down and they occupied Guillemont Barracks.
Before
the brigade arrived. And by the time that the brigade arrived, it had been decided by higher authority to put the Fusiliers into 6th Brigade and transfer the Calgary Highlanders to the 5th Brigade.
Mm-hmm.
So that instead of having a Western brigade, they injected an Eastern Canadian, French Canadian brigade into the 6th Brigade.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so it should say a battalion rather than a brigade. So we had then...
Well, pardon me, but were they predominantly French-speaking? Did they operate in the language of French?
They were recruited, it seemed to me, chiefly from around Ottawa and Hull.
Mm-hmm. So they had the facility of bilingualism?
Some did, some didn't. I know I took a muster parade of the Fusiliers, and I had one. I one man who just refused to speak because I was taking the muster parade, calling the names, as I thought, pretty good French. And I called out this one, because they were sort of mixed, a chap named O'Brien.
Mm-hmm.
And I called out O'Brien. I knew him, and he wouldn't answer. And I called his name two or three times, and I walked up to him. Mm-hmm. And I said, "Aren't you O'Brien?" He says, "Je m'appelle O'Brien." So...
Stubborn fellow, wasn't he?
Well, apparently there is a... at one time, there were a group of Irish that settled right in that... somewhere on the banks of the Ottawa River, not too far from Hull.
Mm-hmm.
And they were completely integrated. They were completely French in about five or six generations. And he had this Irish name, but he could not speak English.
Mm-hmm.
He lived in that little community, and consequently, he couldn't speak English.
A silly question, I know, but did he look like an Irishman? If one can even look like an Irishman?
Well, if you want to call him a French-Irishman, that's what he was, or an Irish-Frenchman, I don't know.
Call him a French-Irishman.
No, he had both characteristics of a French person, so I guess he was of originally Irish stock, mm-hmm. but...
Watered down after
Watered down to... He was a real French-Canadian in looks.
Okay, but before we get to the brigade getting to England, what were you doing at that time in preparation? You said last day that you were combing the countryside with maps.
Well, we were drawing equipment, such as vehicles, mm-hmm. And getting them all set up on the various... we drew enough vehicles for our brigade headquarters, and we drew a few vehicles so that when the battalions arrived, they'd have immediate transport.
Mm-hmm. We drew it from the British?
Well, we drew them from the British ordnance stores.
Mm-hmm.
And there was an advance party for each battalion, so that all we had to do was just coordinate. They'd phone us and say, we want the Cameron advance party down here today to draw stores, barrack stores. Mm-hmm. They got the vehicles first, then they drew their barrack stores and so on and so forth. And that's what we were doing. And I went around just checking to see that with the representatives of each of the battalions to make sure that they were getting what was due them,
mm-hmm.
in the way of stores.
Would it be safe to say, or fair to say, that you were doing staff work at this time?
Oh, yes, I was doing staff work.
But you had no staff experience or training in the past, had you?
Well, only as an adjutant in militia.
Mm-hmm.
And as a 2IC of a company, I had the basic groundwork, mm-hmm. and I knew. Because some of them who had been in the militia or in the army a short time, some of the officers, it was just a routine thing to me.
Mm-hmm.
And they'd say, how do you know that?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I said, I've been in the militia for 10 years. I should know something. And they said, gee, and they'd look at me with their eyes popping out of their heads. And to them, I was just a moving lexicon,
mm-hmm.
In army language. So the militia training I had from 1927 until 1939 certainly stood me in good stead,
mm-hmm.
when the balloon went up, no doubt about it.
Yeah. So you felt yourself capable of handling it?
I did. Yeah.
Were you working with other staff, college trained staff officers?
Oh, only the militia staff. You see, I'd had the militia staff course.
Oh, you had?
And yes.
How did that compare to a permanent force staff in England or in India?
Well, I mean, this was just two nights a week for one training season,
mm-hmm.
and then 2 weeks at camp doing tactical exercises.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, the militia staff course, as such, was, well, it about all it did was give you three small initials after your name, which said MSC, which meant you...
Militia
staff course.
Mm-hmm.
But the fact that I had taken the militia staff course automatically set me aside as a staff officer.
Mm-hmm.
And when Brigadier Sergeant took over 6th Brigade, because I had the MSC, after he got down to Shiloh, I wasn't surprised that he called for me to go down and join him in Shiloh, and I went down there. He already had a staff captain,
mm-hmm.
but he didn't have this. He had this vacancy for an OC Infantry Anti-Tank Company.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was a good opportunity for him to get me down to on his staff. So that's the way it worked.
Yeah. Tell me something. Did other militia officers take advantage of this staff training during their... before the war? Or were you one of the few that did this?
Well, if you had the time, you could take it.
Mm-hmm.
And I took it as a... Well, I was qualified for major. You had to be qualified for major,
mm-hmm.
before you could take the militia staff course.
And you were a captain at this time?
And I was a captain at that time, but I was qualified for major.
Mm-hmm. You had passed your promotional exam and you were waiting for the...
Exactly.
Yeah.
And hence my staff, my being pitchforked, I felt, into staff work, because I would like to have remained with the battalion and been the company commander, which mm-hmm. I no doubt would have become mm-hmm. a company commander. But having got the little MSC after my name, I was a marked okay. officer.
Yeah. Any regrets about that?
Yes and no, because there's a, in a battalion, there's a wonderful spirit, and the camaraderie just becomes so strong that if you go on staff work, you feel it when you go down to visit your battalion. God, I'm missing something here. Mm-hmm. I should be with them, you know. That was the feeling. So on three occasions, I was paraded to my respective senior officer and asked to be returned to my unit.
Mm-hmm. You went up to Brigadier Sergeant and said, I want to go back?
No, the Scottish didn't come over until November 41.
Mm-hmm.
So I was a year in England with the 6th Brigade before they got to England. So at that time, I had no desire to go back to Canada and join my unit.
That's why I wouldn't have sent you anyway.
So it was, in 1943, I think it was. I'd had 2 years of staff work, and you do get fed up doing it, you know, because you never know when your job starts or when your job finishes.
And do you perceive it as a job rather than a working within a group of men like a regiment?
Oh, yes. Yeah, as a staff officer, you're much more on your own than you are as an officer in a battalion.
Yeah.
But in 1943, in the spring of 43, I went to the commanding officer of the Scottish, Fred Gabledew, and I said, I'd like to come back. And he says, God, I'd like to have you, Jackie. And he said, how would you like to come back as 2IC?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, oh, Fred, that's nonsense. I says, I'm not ready for a 2IC. Take second in command of this battalion? He says, sure. I said, no. I said, I'll come back as a company commander.
Mm-hmm.
But I said, not as a 2IC. And I happened to know who the 2IC was. So I said, well, where's Des Crofton? Oh, he says, off on a staff course.
Mm-hmm.
Senior officer's course. And I says, well, I wouldn't come in and take over from Des. I know that would be most unfair.
Mm-hmm.
And I says, I'll take a company. So he says, well, how will we arrange it? Well, they had what they called a staff selection committee that met every other week in London.
Mm-hmm.
And they were all senior officers, divisional commanders and brigade commanders, and they had sort of a draft system like you have for the hockey games and the baseball and all this, you know, people get drafted, and they drafted people, you know, they sat around and said, well, I'll take so-and-so, you take so-and-so. So I said, you go to Howard Graham, the commander of 7th Brigade, and tell him that you'd like me to come back as a 2IC, as a company commander. And I knew he was on the staff selection committee because I used to read the minutes as when they came down to divisional headquarters.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that my own divisional commander, Rod Keller, was on the staff selection committee.
Mm-hmm.
So I got paraded to Rod Keller and told him I'd like to be returned to my unit. And he said, well, Adam, he says, well, we'll see what we can do. But he says, as you know, the staff selection committee has control over this. He says, I don't.
Mm-hmm.
He says, although I'm a member. So anyway, my name went up to go back to the Canadian Scottish, and the staff selection committee turned it down with a great big no. So there I was, stuck on staff work.
Mm-hmm. That was your final chance, I guess, to get
there. No, I took one more try at it.
Did you?
I was supposed to do 1st Canadian Corps, and General Curar was the Corps commander, and I got my senior officer, who was Brigadier Lister,
mm-hmm.
to parade me to General Curar. This was in September 43, and I put my request to Curar, and he had a little spike file there. He wrote it down. He says, I'll see what I can do. Stuck this little piece of paper on the spike file, and he said, I'll let you know, Adam. And so about 5 days later, he called me up, and he said, why do you want to be returned to your unit? He says, is it action you want? And I said, yes, sir. I heard you say at an officer's conference that staff officers should not spend more than about 18 months on staff, and then they should go back to their unit for about 3 months at least to get the regimental spirit again. He said it would do them a lot of good, because he said at times staff officers can begin to think that they're running the whole bloody show.
They lose touch. Yeah.
Right? They lose touch.
Yeah.
And so I threw this up in his face. And he said, well, yes, he says, I did make that remark. But he says, if it's action you want, he says, I'll tell you this in confidence, that you'll be in action much earlier than your Canadian Scottish Regiment will.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, we're going out to Sicily within the next 2 weeks. And he says, just keep that under your hat.
Mm-hmm.
So I kept it under my hat. I found myself in Sicily.
Sounds like a dreadful breach of security, him doing something like that.
Not to a staff officer.
No?
No.
Okay, let's get you back to 1940. What sort of arrangements, what sort of problems did it present to have the Fusiliers come into the brigade replacing the Calgary Highlanders?
Well, first of all, it caused despondency and alarm. It wasn't that we didn't welcome them or anything like that, but it was just the feeling. The brigade had gone over, had formed, and had more or less started to gel at Shiloh, and we thought, well, this is great. We're all going over, and we'll all be in the fight as the fighting, the Iron Six, as they called it, and we were building up morale then. They were known as the Iron Six, so it was a shock to find that we'd lost the Calgary Highlanders and had the Fusiliers. And actually, the Fusiliers were not anywhere near as well trained at that time as were the other two battalions in the brigade.
Well, had they had any training before they'd gone to Iceland, or much?
They couldn't have, because they were a militia unit just the same way as the Calgary Highlanders and the South Saskatchewans were.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that the type of training that they had received, and most of them were recruits, they couldn't have had too much training. And from what my summation was, that the officers, from the colonel, the commanding officer right down, they had very little experience, and they didn't seem to have too many individuals from World War I who could supply or give them
experience.
Consequently, they were not, at that time, a good
battalion at all.
Not a good battalion at all, no.
Do you attribute any of this to the French-Canadian aspect of it, of the culture?
No, I don't. Once they got the spirit, and once they started to get really into it, they compared with our other Canadian units quite well. As a matter of fact, they did a hell of a fine job at Dieppe.
Mm-hmm. They were the floating reserve, weren't they?
Yeah. But they did exactly what they were there to do.
Mm-hmm.
And, you can't deny them. They didn't have a good spirit.
Mm-hmm.
But it took a little while to develop it.
Did you? This is looking forward. Did you? Take out and replace many of the officers, as would often be the case with a...
I don't want to talk about that.
Okay.
I'd rather not, because I think it's been written up already.
Mm-hmm. That's not the most pleasant thing to talk about, I guess, especially when you know the men. And
I can give you examples. We did an inspection, and they had their transport section. I think their establishment was 12 motorcycles.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we were doing the inspection, he had the 12 motorcycles on parade, all right. And I found out that four of them were non-runners.
Really?
They just wheeled them out on parade and stood beside them because I asked them to start their cycles. And four of them told me they wouldn't go. And of that section of 12, there were only four motorcycles that were operable.
Really?
How did they allow
it to get to that state?
I think they just didn't have... They didn't have the know-how. They had an LAD officer with them and an LAD section, but their other vehicles were going on the Fritz too. They didn't know anything about daily maintenance, daily care of their vehicles.
Right.
And see, they couldn't have had too many in Iceland,
mm-hmm.
because they certainly were ignorant of how to keep their vehicles in repair.
Mm-hmm.
So that was one example. And then I inspected the cookhouse, and there's a chap there. I thought he was wearing one of those black balaclava hats.
Mm-hmm.
When I got up to him, I found it was his hair, and it was just out like a like this African's haircut.
The afro, yeah.
Yeah. And in the army to have a thing like that, and a cook especially.
Oh.
And their cookhouse wasn't very clean.
No.
Oh. So these are the things that. That we were faced with, and we didn't have any catering corps or anything like that in those days. They were just the battalion cooks.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't have any Army Service Corps cooks come in, you know, like they had at the latter part of the war.
And I should think that a battalion or regimental cook from a militia unit wouldn't have that much practice before the war at cooking, unless they were a cook to begin with.
Well, there could have been the odd one who would, well, they were from Ottawa, there must have been maybe some cooks or sub-cooks or whatever you call them,
yeah.
that had some experience, because I know I messed with them until the brigade came over.
Mm-hmm.
And actually their table, the officer's mess, was excellent.
Mm-hmm.
And the food was good.
Mm-hmm.
But there you are, they might have had a cook or two cooks from the Chateau Laurier for all I know.
Yeah.
But I don't know what the men were getting, but when I inspected the cookhouse, I thought, oh my goodness.
Well, where did the decision come from for the move? Was it come from division?
What, to switch the two battalions?
Yeah.
Now that I can't tell you. I don't know who decided it.
Yeah.
But it was done.
How did Sergeant react to it?
He didn't like it.
Mm-hmm.
Because, well, you know, when you're given your brigade and said, here's your brigade, and you've got three battalions, Western battalions.
Mm-hmm. All prairie men.
All prairie men, and you're going to take them into action. He was happy because he says, I understand these people,
mm-hmm.
right down to, you know, the way they think.
Was he a prairie man himself?
Yes, he was born on the prairies.
Mm-hmm.
He had served in World War I with the 5th Alberta Cavalry.
Really?
Yeah.
So he had a feeling for the men, and I guess that was totally upset when they...
Right.
Yeah. So what happened when they joined? Now, what was there any animosity between the two battalions that joined up with the Fusiliers, or did the men just accept it and work with it?
They were so interested in getting their battalion, you know, and getting an identity with the battalion and turning it into they were going to be the best. The Camerons were going to be the best. The South Saskatchewans were going to be the best,
mm-hmm.
and so were the Calgarys. And there was keen competition amongst them.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, when the Fuse MR came in, they both the other battalions says, oh, Christ, there's no competition here. That was sort of the attitude. Mm-hmm. So they left them alone,
mm-hmm.
to fend for themselves, more or less. And as I say, a great percentage of them didn't speak English.
Mm-hmm.
So that you couldn't have too much communication between the officers.
Mm-hmm.
And the men of the other two English-speaking battalions.
Would it be fair to say that it decreased the effectiveness as a unit of the brigade?
Initially, very much so.
And how did you overcome, over time, the effectiveness? Regain
Well, unfortunately, Chris, I wasn't there long enough.
How long were you there?
I was there from, they came over in December, and I left in June, 41, so it was only 6 months.
Mm-hmm.
And actually 6 months training. They came up a lot.
Did they?
In the 6 months training, yes.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't see them, like, at their best, say, in 1942.
Just before the Dieppe.
Just before Dieppe, I didn't see them.
Mm-hmm.
But I came back to take the first Junior War Staff course at Kingston.
How would you have been selected for that, because of the initials after your name?
Well, both Brigadier Sergeant and the Brigade Major, Sherwood Lett, recommended that to the Divisional Commander that I get the Junior War Staff course.
Mm-hmm.
And I was interviewed by General Odlum, who was commanding the division at the time. And I think with especially the recommendation from Major Lett at that time, who was the brigade major, because he and Odlum were great pals in Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
And Odlum had so much confidence in Lett that if Lett made a recommendation, Odlum would just automatically accept it.
Mm-hmm.
So that's hence I came back on the War Staff course.
Lett was an SSR, wasn't he?
Lett?
Yeah.
Well, he commanded, but he commanded the SSR after he was brigade major, after my time, after I'd gone.
Mm-hmm. His name has cropped up for me before, that's why I noticed it.
His background,
mm-hmm.
he was in the Canadian Corps Signals in World War I.
Really?
He was a signal officer. And after the war, he joined the Irish Fusiliers in Vancouver.
Mm-hmm.
And stayed with the Irish Fusiliers Militia until the war broke out.
Mm-hmm.
And then, when Roy Sargent got 6th Brigade, he asked for Lett as his brigade manager.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the way it worked.
Okay, you were sent back from England to Canada.
Yeah, I had a 19-day crossing.
Really? On what ship?
It was a ship called the Artois.
Artois.
It had been called the Artois. It was originally a French ship, and it was a 4,000 tonner.
Mm-hmm.
And at the beginning of the war, she was lying in a. And then she was subsequently refitted and renamed the Balt Rover.
The what?
Balt Rover.
Balt Rover?
B-A-L-T. B-A-L-T Rover. Balt Rover.
What does that mean?
It roved to the Baltic Sea. And she had been used from the end of World War I until the beginning of World War II as a ship that ran out of some port in, I guess it would be Hull. In England, and across the North Sea and into the Baltic, and she was sort of like a passenger cargo ship that carried cargo between Britain and the Baltic ports.
Mm-hmm.
And she had capacity for, I think it was supposed to be, she had 12 cabins, passenger cabins.
Mm-hmm.
So she probably carried 24 passengers on a voyage, and when we arrived to get on the Balt Rover, I came aboard. There were about 30 of us returning to Canada. There must have been 10 or 12 or more of us for the War Staff course. And then there were others being returned to Canada for Adjutant General's disposal. They hadn't behaved themselves too well while they were overseas. but we got on board, and oh, by the way, going over, I went overseas earlier with the Calgary Highlanders. Mm-hmm. The Calgary Highlanders came over as a body in September 1940. Mm-hmm. And Fred Scott, who was commanding the Calgary Highlanders, as soon as I stepped on board, he says, "Adam, come here." So he introduced me to the captain of the ship, Captain Falls, his name was. And he says, "I want you to be ship's adjutant." And I said, "Yes, sir." And so then he introduced me to Falls, and Falls says, "You go and see my first officer. His name is Wells, and he's in a cabin up something, and make your number with him." Well, which I did. And he and I got along very well. I was ship's adjutant, and he is first officer. And then he introduced me to the purser, and I went around with the purser, finding out cubby holes on the ship, and so on and so forth, or we could set up an adjutant's office, and so on. Well, anyway, we had a nice, comfortable passage, actually almost peacetime passage, peacetime accommodation, mm-hmm. peacetime food. It was just I thought, this is marvelous. What lovely war this is going to be.
Were you taking anything back from England to Canada in the storage or in the
The original ship I got on when I went over with the Calgary Highlanders,
mm-hmm. was I'm sorry, you got peacetime accommodations when you went over to England?
Yeah.
That's hard to believe. Yeah.
Oh, this is... Well, I'll tell you the story on that. I'm getting ahead of myself, and I'm telling you about my return.
Yeah.
We got on the ship, and it was called the Pasteur.
Mm-hmm. After Louis, I guess.
It was a Louis Pasteur, and she was a 30,000-tonner passenger ship, practically new. And with the fall of France, she was on the South Atlantic run, running down to Rio de Janeiro and back. Mm-hmm. And she was tied up at Bordeaux. And when France capitulated to the Germans, mm-hmm. they managed to get her out of Bordeaux, and they ran her over to New York. And she was lying in New York, and the British Admiralty mm-hmm. got their hands on her. And they took off all the pro-German crew and left the Vichy French crew on board, mm-hmm. whom we felt very suspicious of, no doubt, and crewed her with the Cunard White Star Line crew. Mm-hmm. And Cunard White Star Line took her over. And they ran her up to Halifax. And the Calgary Highlanders, 1,100 strong, it was about 1,100 of us. Went back to Britain, or across to Britain, in the Louis Pasteur. Mm-hmm. And as soon as she arrived in Britain, they just stripped her and made her into a transport ship. And I don't know how many she carried. I never saw her after that. Oh, yes, I did. This fellow Wells, the first officer, this is a connection I want to make. When I stepped on board the Baltrover and was just walking around, someone stepped out of the officer's quarters up in the behind the bridge. Mm-hmm. Wells.
Again.
He was commanding the Baltrover.
Small world, isn't it?
Yeah.
That?
So to continue the story, mm-hmm. when the staff course was over, mm-hmm. We sailed with Wells 19 days across the Atlantic, mm-hmm. and landed at Halifax on July the 3rd, 1941, and took our staff course. Mm-hmm. And when I was returning to England, we got on board a French ship, 17,000 tonner, called the Cuba. Mm-hmm. And she was also one of these South Atlantic run ships. And of course, she was equipped wasn't equipped for cold weather at all. Mm-hmm. And it was in December. So, as a matter of fact, I left Victoria after I had a few days leave, and I came out home. And left Victoria the day Pearl Harbor was bombed.
Really?
Yeah. So back I went across, and I got to Halifax, and I step on board this ship called the Cuba, mm-hmm. and get my stuff stowed. And there were six officers to a cabin on this trip.
Mm-hmm.
And I got my stuff stowed, and I went up into the salon, as they called it, the lounge.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a civilian sitting in there. And he was the only one in there, and I walked to say hello to him. Wells.
What was he doing there?
He had developed ulcers, and he had spent 3 or 4 months in Halifax in hospital. And he was being returned as a civilian back to Britain to take over another ship.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you this. Are you a superstitious man?
No.
So it had no meaning?
Well, it did after. You know, the fact I felt, look, my God, I must be like the Ancient Mariner. I got someone who looks after me. So, he and I remarked about it, you know, on the last time I saw him.
Mm-hmm.
Well, he and I corresponded, exchanged Christmas cards for a number of years. And then suddenly one year I didn't get a card from him, so I just presume that something's happened.
Well, take me back to the Bolt Rover then. Why did it take you 19 days?
Well, we were in a 34-ship convoy.
Mm-hmm.
And
was it a fast convoy or slow?
Well, convoy speed is determined by the speed of the slowest ship.
Mm-hmm.
So it was a 6-knot convoy.
God, it's
slow.
That's the crawl.
Was it ever? And we went up. We went north of Iceland. And in fact, I think we went almost. We practically shook hands with polar bears. And then we came down the coast of Greenland, and we were slowed down by fog and icebergs.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say, we left. Oh, we were at sea when Russia invaded. Germany invaded Russia.
So in June of 1941?
Yeah, June the 15th or 16th, mm-hmm. or thereabouts, that week.
Did you see any American escorting ships? Because I believe they were escorting around Iceland at that time.
I saw Americans. Now, I can't remember on what passage it was. I think it was the passage when we went first across in 1940.
Mm-hmm. And they were helping to escort you then?
Well, they were out there in the Atlantic, and because I saw a squadron, and I forget who it was. I think it was Wells who told me it was an American squadron, and they had two or three cruisers and 5 or 6 or 7 or 8 destroyers.
Quite a healthy force.
Yeah, and they were running. I think he said, "Oh, they're heading for Reykjavik," and they were going to Iceland. Controlling that area.
Yeah. Well, didn't they eventually send troops up there to garrison?
Well, yes. I think they relieved the fused MR.
Mm-hmm.
Or did they?
Could have been the Winnipeg Grenadiers.
No, the Winnipeg Grenadiers went to Jamaica.
Oh, it was Jamaica they went to?
Yeah, they went
to. I knew they were garrisoned somewhere.
No, the fused MR were the only Canadians that were in Iceland.
Mm-hmm.
And the British had a battalion. They called them the 49th West Riding Battalion. And they were stationed there because when I met them near the close of the war, they were under command, 1st Canadian Corps, or 1st Canadian Division.
Mm-hmm.
And I met them in Antwerp, and they were wearing white polar bears. And they were Dutch people called them the polar bears because they had this white polar bear, and they called themselves the polar bears. Now, they'd been stationed in Iceland at some time during their
during the war, because they couldn't have done it pre-war.
No.
So
they either they or the Americans took over from the Fuse MR when the Fuse MR left Iceland.
Mm-hmm.
And as I say, the 49th West Riding Battalion.
Any threat of U-boats on the convoy back?
Well, September, going over on September the 10th, we had a scare.
Mm-hmm.
And some of the boys claimed they saw a torpedo go and cross the bows of the Pasteur.
Mm-hmm.
But,
she was a fast boat, wasn't she?
She could do 30 knots.
Yeah.
But she stayed in convoy.
Mm-hmm. That's foolish, isn't it, really?
Because
Queen Elizabeth, I know she would go at her own speed because she could outrun everything.
Well, going back
mm-hmm.
on the, when I went back on the Cuba,
mm-hmm.
Pasteur was in the same convoy. And she apparently signaled the convoy commander and said that she had a stereoscopic stabilizers in her.
Mm-hmm.
And apparently the stabilizers broke down. And apparently they were always breaking down. I think it was a good excuse. But she said, we're going to make a run for it. So Pasteur took off, and she was in Gurek. 3 days ahead of us.
Mm-hmm.
That was an 8-day crossing with the Cuba. It was a troop ship convoy, so we really moved.
Mm-hmm.
We were doing 17, 18, 20 knots.
Mm-hmm.
As I say, that was in December 41.
Okay, tell me about the staff college. Where was it held?
It was held right in the RMC barracks at Kingston,
mm-hmm.
Fort Frederick.
How large a class was it?
Gosh, I have a picture of them somewhere. They were about, a 100,
mm-hmm.
thereabouts. And they not only came from overseas, but they had also a number of candidates from Canada itself.
Were they all about your age, all your rank? You were a captain at this point,
right? I was a captain. No, there were majors. That was the senior. The senior was major. There's the odd subaltern, too, there. On that course with me was Jean-Victor Allard, who became Chief of General Staff.
Mm-hmm.
And Dollard Menard.
Who has been in the news recently.
I'll get you something.
Okay.
Just a sec. You want to shut that up?
Okay, we're back now, and we're talking about the staff college, and you were telling me about the quality of two officers in particular, Allard and Menard.
Right.
And how, as opposed to what you had experienced with the Fusiliers,
that's right.
These men represented quite an advance and improved your impression
that's right.
of French-Canadian officers.
Yes, very much so.
Yeah.
There were two or three other French-Canadian lads on there that I enjoyed their company and found them to be of just really astute and smart fellows.
Mm-hmm.
The general caliber of the officers who attended that course was, I would consider, very high.
Mm-hmm.
Had
most been militia officers before the war?
Yes. Most had been either militia officers or were permanent force.
Mm-hmm.
Menard was permanent force. He was, he'd been a captain R22R.
Mm-hmm.
And Jean Allard was from the Régiment de Trois-Rivières. And he and I had a common bond because we were both machine gunners.
Mm-hmm.
And consequently, on exercises, we'd be thinking machine guns and how we'd place our machine guns.
Were you through the same syndicate?
Yes, very often the same syndicate. Sure. They change syndicates all the time. But I was with Menard, two or three syndicates, and I was with the Jumbo, as we used to call them. That's Allard,
mm-hmm.
On two or three syndicates, too.
Why did you call him Jumbo?
Pardon?
Why did you call him Jumbo?
He was a big, heavy-set fellow.
In good shape or just husky?
He was in good shape, but he was just well put together.
Mm-hmm. Is it a nickname that held?
Well, as far as I know, I don't know, as he climbed up the ladder, how many officers called him Jumbo. But he came to the staff college with the nickname of Jumbo, mm-hmm. so therefore it stuck with him.
Yeah.
While we were at staff college, I guess it was easier to say Jumbo than it was to say Alarg.
Were they perfectly bilingual?
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And the course was held in English?
They had a slight accent, mm-hmm. but they were fluent. They could think in English and think in French, too.
You can imagine how difficult it would be for a French Canadian, if English is a second language, to have to try and get by in that environment where English, you have to write everything in English and think in English.
Yeah.
It's very difficult.
I imagine it would be.
It's like for you trying to get by in Latin.
Exactly.
Well, tell me, was it a highly intensive course, much like you would expect?
Oh, it was a killer. In the middle of the course, all we got was 72 hours,
mm-hmm.
and we're right back at it again.
How long was the course for?
It started in the latter part of June, and it finished the end of November.
You had 72 hours, that's it?
That's all we had.
And it would go 7 days a week?
7 days a week. And as soon as we had little pigeonholes, boxes, mm-hmm. little pigeonholes, and those boxes were never empty.
Mm-hmm.
As soon as you finished one exercise and finished whatever your submission was, you said, "God, thank God that's finished. I'll go over and put it in my box. There's another exercise, another thing to do."
Mm-hmm.
And we had a couple who practically became babbling idiots.
Mm-hmm.
They just couldn't stand. It was just to see if you could take the pressure.
Yeah.
And so we had 72 hours off, and it wasn't long enough for me to get back to Victoria again.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a flight lieutenant on the course. He was the only representative of the Air Force, and his name was Hornell.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, "What are you going to do, Jack, over the 72 hours?" And I says, "Well, God, I don't know. I've got nobody down here to go to, or probably I'll go into Toronto and just monkey around there." He says, "Well, why not come with me?" He says, "I have my family lives in Mimico, which is a suburb of Toronto."
Mm-hmm.
And he says, "Come with me and we'll take a tour of the Niagara Peninsula," something like that anyway.
Mm-hmm.
So I went with Davy Hornell, and quite enjoyed. We visited one night with his family, and then we took off and we went down to Niagara, to the Niagara by the